Good morning or afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Nick Burnett, and this is the first lecture of the podcast lectures for Comp Studies 103, Sections 11 through 18. I trust that we're going to be able to work together this semester to make this kind of experiment work. I'm very much anticipating hearing from you and your feedback on the lectures and on the way that we can improve the course. But in the meantime, we're going to get through it. You're going to have an excellent experience, I think, in the lab sections, which, of course, meet only once a week. But then it's really up to you to be listening to these lectures appropriately and prior to the time when we deal with the specific assignments that might be linked to them. I want to begin today by talking about some course assumptions. And again, as always in these podcast lectures, I think you're going to find that you're going to be better off in listening to these lectures and get more out of these lectures if you're able to follow along with the PowerPoint slides that are available on the website. Just go ahead and download those as well, or you can download them and print them up. Be sure that you've got the actual PPT file because it's easier to manipulate the outcome, whether you'd like to print it as a slide or as a handout or notes or even as an outline. If you have any questions about doing that, check with me, or you can send me a little email. There'll also be some instructions on the website. So let's begin with some course assumptions. Believe me, I understand that some of you may have been hesitant about taking this course, if only because it's a required course outside of your discipline. It's across campus from where the business school is and where you're probably taking most of your classes. And the result is, it's pretty easy to say, well, why should I take this course? Well, apart from the obvious answer, which is that your professors in the School of Business decided that this was an extremely important part of your development and therefore made it a requirement, I understand that one of the things that we can do to help you understand why this is an important course is to make sure that the information that we're bringing you in this course is in fact valuable, that it has clear application to the stuff that you'll be doing in the future and perhaps even to the stuff that you're doing in your classes right now. So in a sense, the information in this course is valuable to the extent that you can actually use it or that you might actually use it in the future. The other thing that will be kind of a hallmark and kind of my guiding theme through this course is that my job is not to simply teach you stuff. My job is not to simply teach you facts and figures, although that will be part of it. My job really here is to equip you with a repertoire of skills to meet a variety of situations. We all know that the workplace and the field of business is changing dramatically. It's not what it was 10 years ago. It's not what it was 15 years ago. It's going to be different next year. And so in order to kind of really equip you with valuable skills, it's not enough just to tell you how to deal with the environment of business today, but rather to equip you with a set of skills, give you a repertoire, in a sense, of different kind of skills for meeting different kinds of situations. So it's not enough to only know one way to lead a small group. It's not enough to only know one way to deal with conflict. We really need a repertoire of skills because different situations are going to demand different kinds of solutions. And whether it's leading a meeting or resolving a conflict, I think we can give you some of those repertoires and acquaint you with some of those repertoires. Finally, I want to go beyond what would simply be a kind of skills-based approach where we simply give you a technique or give you a way of handling things, and to look at the underlying situation behind it and to understand a little bit about the theory that went into creating the answer that we're talking about. The reason is because as situations change, you're going to need to understand really the theories behind some of the things we're going to be talking about this semester. And I think that probably your business professors would share that as well. If you're going to teach somebody how to manage, it's not enough to say, in X situation, do Y. It's also to understand why, given X, you should do Y. So that's what we're going to talk about. So those are some of the course assumptions. And I want to turn for a moment before we get into some other specific content to some kind of fundamental touchstones that we're going to refer to again and again in this class. Very briefly, they are context, process, and truth. And what I'm going to do is talk just briefly about each one of those. Again, if you're following along on the PowerPoint slides, this will be right there in front of you. For instance, this term context. it's very difficult to always know that you're communicating well, that you've chosen the right language, that you've understood what the other person in that interaction is trying to say and the message that they're trying to get across. There's never going to be a 100% meshing between two participants in a communication dialogue. And in order to get closer to a meeting of the minds, we need to understand a whole lot about the context that's going on, because the context can change the message dramatically. The same message sent in different contexts can mean very different things. Let me give you a business example and a non-business example, and I'll start with the non-business example first. I was in the parking lot of the Golden One here over on College Town Boulevard, and just parking and going in to do some business inside the credit union. And there pulled up right next to me is what I would regard as probably the most beautiful car I've ever seen. It was a brand new Jaguar XK8 convertible. It was one of these beautiful, beautiful cars that I can never in my whole life hope to afford, but I certainly am allowed to look lovingly at them when I see them. But this one was a little different. Despite the fact that it was a beautiful car, there on the bumper sticker was a bumper sticker that said, "My other car is a Rolls-Royce." Well, let me tell you, when that bumper sticker is on a 1969 Volkswagen Beetle with three different colors of primer paint on it, that's a funny bumper sticker, right? "My other car is a Rolls-Royce." And you can laugh about it. When you see a bumper sticker that says, "My other car is a Rolls-Royce on a $65,000 or $70,000 Jaguar, let me tell you, that evokes a different kind of message. It's a message that can get you mad. It's a message that sounds arrogant. It's a message that, frankly, made me want to walk very close to this car with my keys in my hand. No, I didn't actually key this Jaguar. But the point is the context, the fact that it was on a $65,000 car instead of a Volkswagen Beetle that probably is worth $200, it completely changes the message that's trying to be sent. Let me give you another example that's more business related. Let's say you go to the company picnic and you've been chosen to be on the softball team, even though you don't really want to play softball and you're not very good at it. So they stick you out there in right field, and it's the ninth inning and you're out in the field and your team is ahead and a ball gets hit your way and oh my God. And, thank your lucky stars. You end up making the play. You catch the ball that ends the game and you're kind of the hero and you come running in to be with your other business mates. And there in that kind of moment of celebration, the boss gives you a pat on the behind and says, "Good job." Well, that's fine. You're in a public place. You're at a recreational place, not actually in the business setting. There's been just this extraordinary moment where you've become not the goat, but the hero. And the boss pats you on the behind and says, "Good job." Probably you think nothing of it. However, if that same message is communicated to you, let's say in your business's copy room, right? This is where you go to make copies. They have the big copy machine. It's kind of a little room, kind of close, kind of dark. And you're in there making copies, and the boss slips in behind you and pats your behind, says, "Good job." That's a little different message. That's a message that could actually constitute sexual harassment. It's a message that means something very different, even though it's exactly the same message that's being sent on the ball field, right? It's the same literal words. It's the same nonverbal touch, but the context is what makes all the difference. So we're going to be paying a lot of attention to context as we talk about communication, and we're going to be talking about appropriateness as we go along. We're going to try and figure out what role context plays as we go forward. The second fundamental concept that I wanted to talk about that's relevant both in the study of communication and in this class is the term process. What I think I'm trying to get you folks to understand about process is that communication is not a thing. It is not a fixed product. Communication evolves. Communication, in some ways, you may have trouble finding a beginning and an ending point. And the result is that we're on far stronger turf talking about communication as something that evolves, as a process that can change over time, than we are to thinking about it as a single product with a single beginning and a single end. Simply the nature of communication is that communication functions as a process, that it needs to be examined in that light and not thought of as, you know, the memo. The memo may be the product of a communicative transaction, but it is not the same as the communicative transaction. It is merely one part of the message. The final one that I want to talk about in the final term here in fundamental concepts is the notion of truth. Truth here kind of with a capital T, meaning absolute truth. In my field, and it's a subfield of communication studies that really forms one of the cores of the discipline, rhetoric, at the heart of rhetorical studies is this notion that in many of our everyday life circumstances, we can't know the absolute truth of a situation. If we're asking to adopt a particular policy towards employee leave, we can't say for certain what is the best leave package, what is the best philosophy to adopt towards family leave, say. All we can do is make our best guess based on the evidence that we have, understanding the situation as best we can. It's not the same as being in the hard sciences, where we know because of lab experiments that if we take element A and element B and combine them, that we're going to get compound C every time. No matter who does the experiment, no matter how many times we do it, it's not going to change. Well, that's not the situation with communication. We can't guarantee that the message that worked previously is going to work again next week, and we're going to have to figure out why those changes happen and how it works. So when we talk about the truth of the situation, we really are talking about situational truths. We're talking about things being more or less true, and that really forms the basis for persuasion and moving forward. Okay. Now, your Adler text actually does a very nice job in the first chapter of talking about some of the kind of guiding principles of communications, and I'm going to add a couple here. Some of these overlap, but nonetheless, I think they dovetail rather nicely with what is going on in that first chapter there. Again, if you're reading along with the PowerPoint slides, you're going to find that this is a little bit easier. One of the kind of touchstones of the study of communication that was established fairly early on was the notion that you cannot not communicate. That is, even to do nothing is often to send a message. Think about if your best friend throws a party, you decide to not show up. You can say, well, I didn't communicate any message because I wasn't there. But the fact is, you know, don't you, that your absence was actually a message. The fact that you didn't show up for their party that they planned long and hard sends a message to that person about whether or not you care about them, whether or not you cared about the party that was being set to, you know, put together. Because we don't always have to be intentional in communicating. You have to understand that even silence communicates. To say no comment really is to make a comment, and we've heard that repeated in the media again and again during some of the scandals this year. It's important to understand that, again, because communication can be both verbal, that is using words, or nonverbal, using touch, using glance, eye contact, things like that. Your mere presence may be said to communicate. That means that you have to be very careful when you're in interactions with people, because you may think you're saying nothing. You may think you're withholding comment. You may think that silence is the best answer, but perhaps by avoiding conflict, you're making a comment to the people involved in the conflict as well. So you have to be very careful in understanding that you cannot not communicate. So it's probably in your best interest to figure out strategically what is best for you and to move that communication interaction forward. The second one here, we've already addressed a little bit. Really, what we're talking about again is that you should always judge communication in terms of its context. That pat on the behind that might be perfectly harmful and perfectly appropriate on a softball field means something, again, entirely if it's in the copy room when no one else is around and it's just you and the CEO. So think very carefully when you're talking about judging communication that you're using appropriate language, that it's used in the way and in a context that's appropriate. A third observation to kind of get things rolling here is also the notion that the words that we use, that language is an inherently arbitrary symbol system. What does that mean? What I'm trying to get at here is that there's no necessary connection between a word and the thing that it represents. So, for instance, if I say the word T-A-B-L-E, table, to you, you probably all have a pretty good idea in your mind about what it is I'm talking about. But there's no necessary connection between that unique combination of letters, T-A-B-L-E, and what T-A-B-L-E as a word represents. It's a completely arbitrary connection. You only learn that the word table means that thing that you're sitting at to have dinner at night because you've learned it, because you've been socialized, because you've become a competent communicator. You learn to connect that unique combination of letters and the word table to the thing table, that hard wooden four-legged structure that you have dinner on at night. Okay, it's just as possible that because it's an arbitrary system, I could say that, you know, let's have dinner tonight. Here, I've made the chicken parmesan. Please go over there and put it on top of the zucchini. Well, wait. Now, what are we talking about? Well, it's possible that the wooden structure with four legs, that we could call it a zucchini. And as long as you've been socialized into it, then there's nothing incorrect about using the unique combination of letters to represent what we now call a table, as long as that's what the, you know, your culture has socialized you to it. There's no necessary connection that a table be called a table. A table could be called a zucchini as long as the people in the culture use that unique combination of letters for that particular object. What this comes down to and why this is important is it's meant to make you appreciate how problematic the use of language can be. Because words don't have inherent meanings. We learn what words mean by using them, by becoming educated, by working in that environment and understanding that context and that situation. So the result is you have to be able to kind of make connections and understand meanings for words by living it, by working in that area, by becoming educated, and it is not a simple process. It is not simply that a word means a thing and we can simply go forward from there. And let me give you an example of that and then illustrate what is in fact my fourth observation, this notion that communication is polysemic. P-O-L-Y-S-E-M-I-C. A great college word. You can go home and tell folks that you learned a new word today. Communication is polysemic means simply this. Words are capable of supporting multiple interpretations. The same word can mean something very different. If I tell you, if I see you're going over to the Union around noontime, and I say, oh, bring me back some lunch, get me a hot dog, and you come back with a warm poodle, that's technically meeting the terms of hot dog, but a competent communicator would have understood you're going to the Union, it's lunchtime, he wants a hot dog, he's not looking to adopt a sweaty pet. Okay? Just because the term hot dog is the same for both, you have to, in order to be a competent communicator, understand that the meaning that is meant in that particular situation is probably the food item and not the pet. Okay. Another great example of this is from a few years back, a skit that they did on Saturday Night Live, which really illustrates this rather beautifully. They set it up so that the manager of a nuclear power plant was retiring. And in the retirement dinner, everybody was wishing this guy well. And finally, the retiree gets up to speak, and he thanks everybody for the fine career he's had. And his closing words to these people who are going to be running the nuclear power plant in his absence are, remember, you can't put too much water in a nuclear reactor. Now, think about that phrase for a minute. You can't put too much water in a nuclear reactor. What does that mean? Well, of course, they began in the skit arguing almost immediately that what it means is you can put lots and lots of water in a nuclear reactor and everything will be fine. Other people listen to that same term, you can't put too much water in a nuclear reactor, and say, oh, no, listen to it. Well, what he's saying is you shouldn't put very much water in a nuclear reactor at all. Well, of course, you know, things ensue. The next thing you see on the screen is a big mushroom cloud, as they obviously made the wrong choice. But the important purpose here is to note that here you've got a phrase, you can't put too much water in a nuclear reactor, that's not only supporting different meanings, it's supporting meanings that are in fact 180 degrees divergent, exactly opposite things. Putting lots of water in the nuclear reactor, putting very little water in the nuclear reactor, both could be said to be legitimate translations of the same phrase. Communication is polysemic. It means that we have to be careful with the words that we use. We have to be sure that the people who are going to be consuming these messages that we're creating are going to interpret them in approximately the same way we are. When we use a term, what does it mean? This was really illustrated beautifully recently, well, a tragic situation, but there is a kind of illustration here. The Minnesota bridge collapse. In the aftermath of that Minnesota bridge collapse, which happened in about, what, we're talking August 2007, you may be listening to this podcast somewhat later, engineers around the country were said to have, were quoted as saying, oh yeah, well, this bridge was structurally deficient. And other bridges around the country. In fact, in California, I think there were something like 1,700 bridges that are actually rated by engineers as structurally deficient. Now, here's an interesting problem. Structurally deficient to the average person sounds like you should be replacing this bridge. If it's structurally deficient, doesn't that mean that it's falling down? Well, to an engineer who's a specialist in bridges and the civil engineering kind of science that goes behind bridges, and the, somebody who has mastered the rating system that it's a, that's been adopted at the federal level and used by all the state Caltrans kind of outfits, structurally deficient doesn't mean imminently falling down. It means something very different to them in their kind of technical jargon, in the words and the language that they use and the rating system they use when they're examining bridges. And the problem you have, of course, is when an engineer says this bridge is structurally deficient, it merely means that it has to be observed and watched, and that there could be some problems that may result in the future. When the average layperson hears structurally deficient, they think like, oh my God, the bridge is going to fall down. Why are we allowed to drive on it? This is clearly a situation where the language adopted by the civil engineering community, by the bridge engineers, doesn't mean the same thing to the average citizen. And so because communication is polysemic, because things words are capable of multiple meanings, we have to be extremely careful about how we choose the words we use and who we address them to. Okay. I think I want to move on and talk at this point about the relationship between communication and organizations as a whole. Because I think sometimes when we say we're going to study organizational communication, as some people in my field do, or if I tell you that what we're going to do is study communication in businesses and in organizations, that it's like a feature of that organization that we can kind of separate out and simply look at, you know, like examining somebody's fingernails, you know. We don't have to look at the whole person, we can just look at their fingernails. Well, in fact, the argument that I want to make is that communication is not a secondary aspect or a derived aspect of an organization. It is not merely a helper. It's not merely something that can be kind of scalped off and examined separately. Really, what I'm trying to get at here is that communication is an intrinsic, inherent, and indeed a defining feature of organizations. The thing is, you cannot have organizations without a way for people to communicate in them. You cannot have organizations that don't have any communication. And when we talk about examining communication, we're talking about examining the lifeblood of organizations, and there's really no way to kind of decrease it in importance. It is a central and defining feature of what organizations are. You see a quote there from a previous textbook that I've used in this class before that says that no human relationship could be maintained, no organizational objective achieved, no activities coordinated, and no decisions reached without communication. It is part and parcel, an essential element of organizations and of businesses. And as we study communication in organizations, we are in fact studying those organizations themselves. So I want you to kind of get the notion. I'm not trying to kind of place communication studies at the core of what it is the College of Business Administration does. That's not the argument I'm making here. But what I am arguing is that there is more to a business than its financial books. There is more to a business than the building that it is housed in. That really, when you talk about the way a business operates, the way it communicates with the outside world, the way in which its employees are trained or motivated or disciplined, all has to do with communication. And therefore, I think you'll find that communication can be a very interesting lens through which you can investigate organizations. I'm not saying it's the only way. I'm not saying that if you understand communication in organizations, you don't need accounting. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm simply saying it's another way to get into and study organizations. Your textbook does a rather nice job, I think, of trying to communicate the complexities of how communicate operates in organizations. And in fact, in Chapter 1, they introduce you to the notion of network analysis. When we talk about network analysis, we're talking about the connections that are made either formally through an organizational chart or informally within organizations so that people talk to one another. And so what I want to do is to kind of look at some of the patterns of communication that can exist in these networks, right? There's more in your Chapter 1 about this, but I want to just highlight some things. One of the first organizational features that people studied when they came from communication studies to work on and study businesses and the way in which communication operates in large organizations is they first looked at what we call downward communication. That is, messages that derived at the top of the organization and were targeted towards people lower down in the organization. In the kind of classic circumstance, it's the boss talking to the employee. It's the superior talking to the subordinate. In the early 1950s, when communication studies first started to kind of pay attention to these kind of things, downward communication was one of the first things that was studied. And frankly, this is not surprising because a lot of the early money that went into the study of organizations came from large corporations. And they were interested in downward communication because they were interested in how to do a better job of motivating employees. They were looking at doing a better job of giving instructions to employees and how to make that more efficient and make sure that what the boss wanted was actually communicated to the subordinates. And so there was a lot of time and effort and a lot of studies done on downward communication, on giving orders. And that's, again, as I said, not surprising given who was kind of funding things. Downward communication is still very important today. It's something that you have to think about as a manager, about how it is you're going to communicate with folks. And there are some very complex choices because it's not only what you're going to say to your troops, what you're going to say to your subordinates, to the people that you manage, but in what channel are you going to say it to them? Are you going to send them a formal memo? Are you going to send them an email, an instant message? Are you going to drop by their desk and tell them face to face? All of these are choices that you have to make when you're getting ready to send a message, whether it's downward or anything else. As the human relations movement, which we'll talk about in the next lecture, became more and more important in the 50s and the 1960s, it became clear that focusing just on the downward communication in organizations was not enough. That in fact, an important part of having a broader view of an organization and one in which people participated more fully, you had to have a better notion of how communication moved not only top to bottom, but also bottom to top. That in fact was as important as really anything else, because that was how you got information about what was happening down on the shop floor. That was how you got information about what was happening from your sales reps out in the field. And as the human relations movement, which kind of saw the employer-employee relationship more as a partnership rather than one in which you simply give directives and wait for results, what you end up with is management being more concerned with generating a flow of information from the bottom of the organization to the top. If you want to think about easy ways, or one of the most natural ways that communication flows upward in almost any organization, my guess is if your company is big enough to have a break room, a place where you go to have lunch or where you take a break and have a cup of coffee or read a book for your 15-minute break, my guess is that they already employ an instrument of upward communication that's available in lots and lots of organizations, and that, believe it or not, is simply the suggestion box. The suggestion box often allows members of an organization to ask questions of the superiors, sometimes without even revealing who they are. They can ask questions, they can make suggestions. Some cases, I've heard of organizations, and you probably have too, where they actually encourage communication from their lower employees in the organizational chart about ways to save money, about ways to become more efficient, to the point where they have contests where they'll give, you know, $5,000 for the idea that saves the most money for that particular year. There have been other organizations where, frankly, they say, we'll give you a percentage of the money saved in the first year by an idea. Now, you have to be careful about this because, frankly, you may not be prepared for what happens. There's an example in the state of Massachusetts where a worker in the welfare department figured out a very simple thing that could be changed that would ultimately save the state of Massachusetts over the course of the first year simply by changing the way they deal with the flow of money in the department and how it comes in from the federal government, that it was going to save them something like $35 million. And the thing is that the employee made the suggestion to the state, came up with this solution that saved all this money on the basis of a program that they had begun that said that the state would pay the employee 10% of the savings for the first year in which that change was implemented. Well, let's think about this. If you're the employee and you've just made a suggestion that saves the state $35 million, you might be justifiably thinking that you're going to get a very, very large check. So the state of Massachusetts got together a big program, and they're going to have a news conference, and, you know, they're, of course, going to bring out one of these gigantic cardboard checks to give to the employee. But on the day of the ceremony, the day of the press conference, out comes the check made out to the employee for a total of $10,000. Well, as nice as it is to get a check for $10,000, you would think that this particular employee had expectations of seeing a somewhat larger check, and I'm not talking about the cardboard here, folks. If you save $35 million and the program says you get 10%, I think this employee justifiably says, I should be getting $3.5 million. And in fact, the employee didn't just say so. The employee sued the state of Massachusetts and won the suit. And ended up getting the full $3.5 million. Be careful how you run your programs that encourage give incentives for upward communication. It's a kind of communication that if the executive suite, if the leaders of an organization ignore communication from below, it says something, it sends a message to the workers about how valued they are, about whether or not they're participating in the governance of the organization or of the business. And so just be careful that you understand what you're saying when you refuse to accept upward communication or if you punish people for upward communication. How many people have heard of having a boss that says, oh yes, I have an open door policy? well, that's fine, and that may mean one thing. But the truth is, if when an employee goes in to discuss a problem with the boss, and the next thing that happens is that employee gets fired, I'm not sure claiming an open-door policy there is relevant, because the actions say if you go in and complain to the boss or try to provide them with information or make a suggestion, it may cost you your job. So you have to be consistent. You have to understand exactly what you're saying and what you're encouraging with upward communication. Well, as you can imagine, if you're studying downward communication and upward communication, there's another direction here in terms of a 3D picture of an organization, and that would be communication that runs horizontally. It's communication that happens between members of an organization at a similar level. So it's not superior to subordinate, it's not subordinate to superior, it's the people all at the same level of management talking among themselves. For instance, here on campus, there is a meeting every month called the Council of Deans, in which all the deans of the various colleges on campus, whether it's College of Business Administration, the College of Social Science and Interdisciplinary Studies, the College of Arts and Letters, they all get together, the deans do, with the president once a month. And that is a meeting among equals of people at the same level of the organization. And that is classic horizontal communication. Why do they have those meetings? Well, they want to make sure that everybody knows what's going on campus. They want to make sure that if other parts of the organization have found interesting and creative solutions to problems, that those solutions get shared among the various schools. It's to let, one hand know what the other hand is doing. Horizontal communication, as your book will tell you in the first chapter, is classically about sharing information and about coordination, about making sure that things go smoothly for the larger organization. The final kind of or network of communication that I want to talk about a little bit is called informal communication. This is communication that is not classically derived from a business or an organization's organizational chart. On an organizational chart, you can see who's supposed to report to whom, who we can predict is talking to whom. In an informal communication network, what we're really talking about is people who end up within an organization communicating for reasons that may not be immediately apparent. Let's say, for instance, that you live next door to a person that you work with, but they work in a different department. They may be at a different level of the organizational chart. And it may be that in a formal organizational chart, you would have no specific reason to talk about that person or talk to that person. But since they're your neighbor, since your kids play on the same softball team, since your daughters both have play dates with one another, you're going to end up talking, and you're probably going to end up talking about work and creating an informal connection, or a connection that would have not been planned on an organizational chart, where you end up providing important information to one another. And I'm not talking about revealing corporate secrets, but merely keeping up on what's going on in the organization from your point of view. And this happens because people share the same break rooms. It happens because they're on company bowling leagues. It happens because they share similar interests outside of business. The result is simply that there are these informal networks. It wasn't until the mid-1950s that these informal networks were studied, because I think the kind of standard thinking prior to that was that these things are destructive, that informal communication is something we want to stamp out, that we don't want these informal contacts being made. But in fact, in the Harvard Business Review in the mid-1950s, a fellow by the name of Ken Davis began to study what he called the grapevine, which was his term for an informal network inside an organization. And contrary to what people had believed prior to his studies, he found that, in fact, informal communication was a very important part of organizations, that it shouldn't be discouraged, that, in fact, it should be encouraged, because it gives people a chance to see an organization from different perspectives. He found, for instance, that informal organizational networks were very effective at quickly transmitting information. that and again, despite what everybody's view might have been prior to, Davis suggested that they also tended to give people very accurate information, that not all gossip was lies, that in fact in these informal kind of grapevine situations, they were often transmitting information that was both accurate and it was transmitted quickly. So, again, I think you have to understand how communication works in your organization. It doesn't always work by the standard organizational chart. When we look at communication networks, we might be looking at downward communication. We might be looking at upward communication, communication that moves side to side at the same level, horizontal communication, or even informal communication where people are kind of sharing information throughout an organization. I want to talk for just a little bit about something that's not covered terribly well, I think, in your first chapter. And it's really the notion that one of the ways that people in my field, researchers in the field of communication studies, sought to understand the communication phenomena that was happening when two people sit down and talk or when an organization tries to communicate with the public, to figure out how to model that communication. The impetus for this came in the 40s and 50s when science was really having a profound impact on society. It's just after the point at which two British scientists, Crick and Watson, created what was the first model of the DNA molecule, which was an extremely important moment for 20th century science. And so researchers in my field said, well, let's see if we can model the communication that happens between people. One of the earliest models, and it's very simple, you can just see it on the you can see it on the PowerPoint slide, or you can just simply imagine it being written on a blackboard. It involves four letters and some arrows in between them, and it's simply SMCR, with arrows kind of connecting and pointing to the right. So S with an arrow to M with an arrow to C with an arrow to R, SMCR. Oddly enough, this was called the SMCR model of communication. And really, it's very simple. It simply tried to indicate that if we're going to try and break down the parts of a communication interaction, that it looks like this. You begin with a source. That's the S, a source. Somebody has to initiate the communication, these folks said. That source has to create a message, some information that they want to transmit. They go through a C, which in this case is a channel. They have to figure out how they want to transmit it. Do they want to say it face to face? Do they want to write it down? Do they want to use words, or do they want to use nonverbal kinds of channels? Again, the channel is an important consideration in contemporary business. Do you put it in email? Is this something that can be communicated by putting up a notice on a bulletin board? Or is it something that you have to make sure that managers individually tell to their subordinates? Again, choosing the channel can be very important. The final element in this SMCR model is the R, the receiver. Who are you trying to target? Who is your audience? Who ultimately is getting your message? And while this brought a little order to the discussion of how communication works, there were, as soon as this model was kind of put forward in the discipline, there were people who stepped up to say that this really isn't a very good model of communication. For instance, they argued that this was too linear. It showed communication going simply in one direction from source to providing a message through a channel to a receiver, and it was all going in one direction. So they didn't like the linearity of it. They said communication is a lot more complicated than that. They also said that it shows communication as something that's static, right? It begins and it ends. It begins with the source, it ends with the receiver, it's done. That it's very simplistic to show it that way, when in fact, because it is a process, it's actually much more complicated. They also didn't like this model because they said, well, it doesn't really have any kind of feedback loop in it. What if, you know, in receiving a message, the receiver rolls their eyes, commenting on the message or saying, what are you, stupid? Or, you know, turns around and gives you a glare. That's a feedback. That's a message being sent back to the source, telling them to maybe they need to alter their message or alter something about the channel in which it was communicated. The point is, they said, Communication involves feedback, and your model, SMCR, doesn't really account for that. And of course, all these critics, to a various degree, were probably right in what they were saying. And in the next 10 or 15 years, lots of folks published and criticized models of communication. Now, I'm not sure that there's an easy visual representation of any model. But what did change about models of communication is that they went from this linear SMCR model to what was called a transactional model of communication, that they saw communication as a transaction. And what this implies is that whenever we are involved in communication, we are both sources and receivers. That in a standard lecture, for instance, if I'm giving this lecture in front of a group of folks, the messages are not simply flowing in one direction. Though I may be the only one speaking, I can have 140 people sitting out there in the lecture hall sending me messages back. I'm talking too loud. I'm too boring. Oh, this is really interesting. Any of those messages might be communicated back to me non-verbally by the people in the classroom. And they may alter the way I actually present my message. Now, unfortunately, with podcasting, I miss that feedback loop because I can't see you rolling your eyes or thinking that, my God, this is so boring. How is it I'm listening to this? Ooh, I really wish I signed up for the traditional 103 lecture. That may all be true. But the point is that with a podcast, the feedback is delayed. The best that I can hope for is somebody shooting me an email saying, wow, I listened to the first lecture and I really think this is going to work out, or I think this is a tragically stupid thing and I'm going to try and move sections. Whatever that is, it's feedback that's an important part. The notion is that instead of having sources and receivers, what we really have are dual participants at the minimum. We actually have to have somebody who may be sending the message and receiving it, but at the same time, they're also sending messages and the original person is receiving. So instead of sending sources and receivers, maybe we should be talking about participants. Let me give you a definition that's kind of a verbal model of communication, because it points out the important things that we have to think about in thinking about the way in which communication works. So try this definition on for size. Again, this is from a fellow by the name, or actually, a fellow by the name of Dodd, and he says that communication is defined as participants interpreting information by interacting through sending and receiving messages across a channel in an organizational context. Now, that is on the PowerPoint slide, but let me repeat it for you again. Communication is defined as participants interpreting information by interacting through sending and receiving messages across a channel in an organizational context. That is a transactional view of communication, because those people are sending, receiving messages at the same time, and they are constantly evolving and changing in response to the messages that they both send and receive. Let me break down that definition a little bit so that we can talk about each one of the elements. Participants. This is really important to understand that when we're talking about participants in communication, we're really talking about uniquely situated actors who are affected by the particular context that they are in. No two people are alike. No message is going to be received by two people in exactly the same way. There's never going to be 100% agreement between the message sent by the sender and the message that is received by the receiver, primarily because each person is a bundle of prior communication, of different educational experiences, of different personal experiences. They come out of a particular culture. They are of maybe a different gender. They may have a different level of education. They may come in a business from a different organizational rank. So that you have to understand that delivering a message to the vice president of an organization is probably a different thing than delivering that same message to somebody who works in the mailroom of that organization. Different organizational rank means that there is different context, and those participants can differ wildly. So if you're trying to design a message that will reach across that organization to all people in that organization. You have to recognize that you have lots and lots of unique participants that are, they're essentially uniquely situated actors in that particular context. The next important part of that definition has to do with interpretation, right? Remember that they're interpreting messages. They're interpreting information by interacting through the sending and receiving of messages. Well, interpretation involves what's called encoding and decoding of symbols. When we encode symbols, what we're talking about is choosing particular words. Okay? When I address an email, do I say, "Good morning, colleagues," or do I say, "Hey, folks," or do I just say, "Greetings," or do I go through and address each individual email to each individual person that I'm sending it to, using their first name? Dear Bill, dear Jose, dear Carlito. Again, encoding is choosing the language that you want to get a message across. Decoding is when these messages are received, meaning is ascribed to them. Oh, here's another, like, dear colleagues memo from the boss. That's how I'm going to react to it because I've seen these dear colleagues letters before. The boss always says we're a big part of a family. Well, if that's the case, you know, he's been the patriarch and, you know, we're getting slapped around. There's a lot of domestic abuse if you want to sustain that metaphor. Interpretation has to do with very complicated processes of both ascribing meaning by choosing language and then interpreting those symbols, those words, the stylistic choices, the rhetorical choices made by the sender of the message, and how they, what they mean to you. Context of the workplace is another part of that definition, right? Again, there is always going to be a context is always important in communication, and because we're generally talking here about organizational or business contexts, we will have to, over the course of the semester, try and understand what is uniquely happening in an organization, in a business, that affects the way communication happens. I think it would be pretty easy to look at the most recent mining disaster in Utah and look at the way the CEO, Mr. Murray, talked to both the victims' families and the press, and understand that the context in that workplace is probably very different than it usually is. And whether or not Murray adapted well to the situation, whether under that particular set of contexts he was doing the right thing, you can do some very interesting criticism of whether or not he stood up to the challenges and the crisis to his company in an effective manner. One of the most important elements of that particular, definition, I'm still here, I just had a little moment there, a definition is the channel, that both sides, both participants choose channels to send information. And how do you make those assessments? How do you know what channel is the right one to send, or is the correct one to use? Do you send a memo? Do you send an email? Do you use a phone call? Do you actually go see the person in person? How would you like to be fired from a job? Would you like to simply get a memo? Would you understand that it was real if it just came as a part of an instant message from your boss? Kind of what happened to my wife recently. I'm not bitter, but we can talk about that later. Of course, the importance is you need to look at a number of different factors in choosing a channel for communication because you have lots of options, and we all have lots of options these days. You might want to look at the importance of the message. Firing somebody is pretty darn important. It's not the same level of importance as asking whether or not you want sugar in your coffee. Okay? You need to look at the needs of the receiver. For some people, it's better to have things that are written down than simply telling them those things verbally. If it's a very complicated message, you especially may need to get those things written down instead of just simply expecting somebody to be able to deal with it verbally. One of the things that we're trying to do in these podcasts is I was really insistent that we end up using PowerPoint slides to accompany them because sometimes just listening to a message orally A-U-R-A-L-L-Y, is not the same as being able to see it. And so I'm trying to kind of provide a little visual context here by having the PowerPoint slides to go along with it. How much feedback is needed, and how quickly is feedback needed? One of the beautiful things about email is it's made feedback both quick, easy, and storable, right? It's become more durable. Instead of somebody giving you a thumbs up at a meeting or giving you the okay symbol, we can simply ask for a quick reply, and we can store those emails. What a great thing that we have not only proof that feedback happened, but also exactly what the message was. There's always the question of whether or not you need to maintain a permanent record for a particular message, and that can affect the channel. Cost is an issue. How formal the message is an issue. Whether or not you want to do it live or whether or not something mediated is important. All of these are questions that you need to think about as you're assessing what kind of channel of communication you choose to engage in with another person to send a particular message. We've already talked about the advantages and feedback, that they can help people adjust their messages, that ultimately they can refine them to the point where you have an increase in agreement between what was trying to be sent and what actually was received. There can sometimes be disadvantages with feedback. Early on in my wife's career, she was in a job where the home office was down in Southern California, and she was the only employee up here in Northern California. And so she would send her boss daily updates on what she was doing and what she was interested in. And that boss didn't want all that information. Because she could give feedback easily, it resulted in an impression that her boss thought that she couldn't work independently, when in fact she was simply trying to keep him apprised of what it is she wanted, she was doing up here. It wasn't until they actually had a very significant talk about exactly what kind of feedback and what kind of reporting he needed from her on a day-to-day basis did they strike really a really solid balance between her needs and his needs. The final note there on your PowerPoint slide is that an important part of understanding how communication happens is to understand that one part of a communication model probably ought to include an analysis of noise, that is, the obstacles that can exist in a situation, in a context, in an organization that makes it difficult for people to get the meanings that are trying to be transmitted. When we talk about noise, we could be talking something literally, like an external noise, like there's a train going by the window, or I've done a terrible job of recording these, and what in fact has happened is I've clipped off the top of what I'm saying as I'm recording. I'm going to do it just to show you that it can be very annoying. If I talk really loud, okay. It crunches, the recording equipment needs a more modulated kind of voice, and I've made it difficult for you to listen to. That is noise in the literal sense, in that it makes it difficult to hear my message, but it also is noise in a sense, you can think of noise more kind of metaphorically, where if I'm using terminology that you're not familiar with, if I'm speaking a language that you're not familiar with, it's going to get in the way. Now, here on the PowerPoint slide, it says external versus internal noise. Sometimes when we're talking about external noise, we're talking exactly like the train going by the window, making it difficult, or that in playing back this podcast, you're trying to do it on a loud bus, and it's making it difficult to actually hear. When we're talking about internal noise, sometimes, for instance, let's say that you're really, really hungry and you're trying to listen to this podcast, and your hunger, in fact, makes you pay less attention. You're becoming more distracted. Or maybe you're caring for a child. That might be an external noise. The internal noise is something internal to the receiver that makes it difficult for them to get something accomplished, to get to understand what's being said. Okay? Technical and semantic kinds of noise. Technical noise is, again, like the train going by, whereas when we talk about semantic noise, we're talking about something based in the language. It may mean that I'm using a more formal tone that you're used to. It may be that if I use too much technical jargon that you're not going to understand the message. That's noise. have to be able to understand what's being said. I'll give an example of noise that almost cost a government official his job. There was a few years ago in Washington, D.C., yet another budget crisis that involved the potential for Washington, D.C. city government needing to make a lot of budget cuts. And what they did is they had a public meeting where they brought folks forward, various representatives from the various parts of the state of the city government, to explain how it was they were spending money. One of the department heads came forward and explained to the assembled crowd, which was about 60% African American, that he was very proud of his department because their attitude towards spending money was niggardly. That's N-I-G-G-A-R-D-L-Y, niggardly. Now, interestingly enough, if you go back and look at the roots of this word, it has absolutely nothing to do with the N-word. It has nothing to do with it. But when it's spoken on a podcast or if it's spoken in a meeting with an African-American crowd that would be incited by the use of the N-word, obviously, problems ensued. Now, the term niggardly is actually a fairly old word that means being very thrifty. It means being careful spending, cheapskate, kind of, okay? So it was exactly the right word, in a sense, that the government official could use to try and demonstrate that his department was very careful with the way they spent money and therefore that they, you know, really couldn't suffer another budget cut. But immediately, like both at the meeting and on talk shows the next day, people were calling for this government official to be, you know, forced to resign or to be fired for being insensitive. And it took a few days through this controversy for people, you know, for calmer voices to prevail and say, look, this guy did make a mistake. He didn't use the wrong word, but he did use the wrong word. And here's how it plays out. This word exactly means exactly what he meant to say. It means to be thrifty. It means that you're a cheapskate. It means you're careful with how you spend your money, which is exactly what we wanted to hear from a government official. But he used the wrong word, in a sense, too, because he should have known that sometimes people react poorly to words that sound like other words. Why use a word like niggardly when you could use the word thrifty? When you could use the word careful. So while everybody was getting all excited that this guy had used some form of the N-word, really what he had done is make an unfortunate rhetorical choice. He encoded badly. He did not consider the context. And so while there were calls for his resignation, eventually things settled down and he probably went back to his division, to his department in city government, having been taught a rather good lesson about the words that we use. And even though they may seem fine to us, that's not the real test here. It's not a test of whether or not he understood the word or whether or not he thought it was a good choice, because the people who will ultimately make that judgment in almost every case is the audience. And so, again, going back to this bridge in Minnesota, structurally deficient may mean something to engineers. But the minute that term hits the public, the kind of plain and everyday obvious meaning of that term is that that bridge is likely to fall down. And if we can go around saying that, you know, thousands and thousands of bridges around the country are structurally deficient, according to these engineers, we need to have, I think, a clearer way of communicating what the actual conditions of the bridges are that wouldn't work just for the structural engineers, but would in fact work for the general public as well. Because remember, those structural engineers, if they're going to get the money to get these bridges fixed, they have to accurately talk in a public manner about the condition of those bridges. They have to do it in a way that doesn't make people think that they're crying wolf. They have to do it in a way that accurately reflects the engineering status of those bridges. So their language has to be made better. They have to think about how they're going to describe these bridges in such a way as to communicate the fact that they are in disrepair, but no, they're not going to imminently fall down. Okay? That, I think, is about all we're going to do for today. We've used about an hour and 5 minutes or so. Again, you're going to be listening to these podcasts, I hope, at your own leisure, but that there will be a certain number of podcasts that you'll have to get done prior to an assignment. So, for instance, before the group special occasion speech or assignment, you're going to have listened to the group lectures. This will all be available on the website, and you can confirm this with your lab assistant. Again, this has been the kind of basic concepts lecture, the very first lecture in the series. I hope you've enjoyed it. This is Nick Burnett. Thanks very much.